We've come to the end of the book of Bereshit, the book of Genesis. It's been a wonderful book full of all kinds of interesting, I would like to call them stories, but they are stories in history. They are, in fact, historical. From the very beginning, when, in a sense, God exploded the worlds into being, rushing quickly through the opening chapters and the opening events of the history of the world and of the universe, then all of a sudden, breaking suddenly. I did say that all of a sudden and suddenly, didn't I? That's good Hebrew. Lousy English, but good Hebrew. To stop for the story of Abraham and his descendants. And that story, in effect, carries us end of the book. But, you remember, that story involves Abraham and the wonderful things God did for him. It involves Isaac and the amazing sacrifice he was willing to make. It involves Jacob, the man who was not once but twice blessed by God, a man who is called Ish Tam, a blameless person. And then, as Hanukkah approached, we started the story that ends the book, the story of Joseph. And it's that story that, we conclude the Jacob story and the Joseph story in tonight's Parsha. It begins in Genesis chapter 47, verses 28 to 31. And as we go through these closing sections, and I'm just going to hop, skip, and jump over some of the texts in this Parsha, we'll find, if we are paying attention, some patterns, some pictures, and some principles as God blesses those he promised to bless. The text begins, as read to you, that it was about time for Jacob to die. And so the text talks about Yemei Yaakov. And then what's interesting is in that first text, or the first part of the parsha, we didn't read it, it's the next line that we read. It talks about Yemei Yisrael. So you begin to see a very interesting, I don't know what to call it, but a sort of a shift taking place from Yaakov to Yisrael. Let's please remember that both of those were his name, Jacob and Israel, and continued to be his name. But it's as if the text is suddenly hinting for us that the focus is going off of Jacob the person to Jacob the people, from Israel the person to Israel of the people. And as it does so, there may be a reason here, and in a sense I sort of hinted at it when I read the text for you. If this is the closing of the book of Bereshit or Genesis, what comes next? Hello. Shemot, beginning of Exodus. Right? In other words, this then becomes the lead into Exodus and to Israel, the people in Egypt. Another thing that takes place in this text is perhaps you might call it the final transfer from Yaakov to Yosef. Because the text then reads for us, Vayikra livno leYosef. Or in other words, Jacob now, as he's about to die, called to Joseph, his son. But what's striking is, we know it's his son. All the readers and hearers of the text know it's his son. But the author chooses to emphasize these words as Moses wrote them. Livno, his son. And then Jacob makes a very interesting request. In order to save time, I won't read all of this in Hebrew and translate in English. I'll just work from the English. He says, in a very interesting formation or structure in Hebrew, if it should now please you, the old English used to say, if it is possible that I have now found favor in your sight, let me stop there for a second. The way in which that's structured indicates that this is a statement of great honor and respect. Honor and respect from Jacob to Joseph. In other words, from father to son. That's usually the reverse of what goes on. It's a statement of great honor and respect, and the fact is that it's aimed at the son is stressed by the insertion of the word Livno, his son. The father asked the son to extend something to him. If I found favor if you should so please, but the Hebrew term is chen. Chen means favor, not just favor, but mercy. It has with it an element of compassion as well. So the request for the son or the ruler to extend this, and then I didn't read this, and then he goes on to say, please deal with me in Chesed ve'emet. Chesed ve'emet, a very striking phrase. I think this may very well be the first appearance of the phrase in the text of the scriptures. It's a very important phrase that describes God, God's relationship with us, and what God has given to us by means of his words for us. And in fact, that particular emphasis is found in the opening chapters of the book that was written by Yochanan HaShliach, John the Apostle. And it talks about how the Torah came to us through Moses, but the grace and truth, usually in English translations, the grace and the truth that is inherent within that Torah is centered in Yeshua the Messiah. Grace and truth. Chesed ve'emet. And so the story begins here. And so the request from Jacob to Joseph is, please deal with me in kindness and in faithfulness. Most of the English translations have at this point, and rightly so. And then we move on to chapter 48, beginning at verse 3. Jacob said to Joseph, God Almighty appeared to me in the land of Canaan, and he blessed me. And he said, I'm going to make you make you fruitful and increase your numbers. And I will make you a community of peoples, and I will give this land as an everlasting possession to your descendants after you. These words should sound familiar, not just because we heard them, not once when God pronounced them to Jacob, but twice. Because remember, he blessed him twice. Same words were transmitted to Isaac. Same words were transmitted to Abraham. In other words, you have a mention here of the renewal of the Abrahamic covenant to Jacob and of God blessing Jacob. God appeared to me and he blessed me. Next thing that we find in our text is Jacob, having been blessed or recalling the blessing, is now ready to bless not his sons, but Joseph's sons, beginning at verse 5. And in fact, he says in verse 5, now the two sons that have been born to you, I'm going to take as my sons. They will not be my grandsons. They will be as if they were my sons. They've been elevated to the status of sonship. So he adopts Ephraim and Manasseh as his own sons. And then, in verse 9, he blesses them. And the story is a very interesting story, as he blesses them. I'll pick it up in a minute. Israel says, bring them to me that I may bless them. He's ready to pass on the blessing. And then, as we look in verse 8 and the beginning of verse 10, once again, we see that Jacob, who's been the actor here, is now consistently being called Israel. In a sense, the emphasis has now been made yet again, that we're moving from the person to the nation. And then, of course, there's the story of the blessing. It goes all the way down to verse 14. What Joseph did is he placed on Jacob's knees his two sons, the elder on the right side, the younger on the left side. Do you remember the story? What does Jacob do? He crosses his hands. He's not cross-eyed, although it causes Joseph to cross his eyes and say, no, you got it wrong. This is the oldest, this is the youngest. And Jacob goes, ow. He understood an important principle coming from God, that he lived out himself. God doesn't always choose the eldest or the most prominent or even the most intelligent, but those who are willing to serve him. And so God chose Isaac, not Ishmael. Isaac was the younger. He chose Jacob, not Esau. Jacob was the emperor. Because these were people that God understood would follow him wholeheartedly. And now, Jacob knows the principle, does the same thing. The younger is blessed and chosen. Okay, then in verses 15 and 16, he blessed Joseph. May the God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who's been my shepherd all my life to this day, and so forth. We've now come full circle. Jacob said he's been blessed, and now he blesses Joseph. The blessing continues. But he says something very interesting. Did you pick that up as I read it? He says that God has shepherded him all his life. That means as a sheep, he has followed the shepherd all his life. Make no mistake about it, because the text is very clear about this. Anyhow, then he talks about the angel that was part of this whole package. Remember, it was the first time he was blessed by God. He was asleep, and then the angels ascended and descended on him. And then as he crossed back into Esau's territory, he started out by wrestling what he thought was an angel. Turns out, as he says, Peniel, I have seen God, I've wrestled God face to face. So he talks about that as well. And then in verse 20, we finally get the blessing on the sons. And he says, he blessed them that day, and he said, in your name will Israel pronounce this blessing. In your name, or in your names, it's plural. Ephraim and Manasseh. And what has Israel done? Every Shabbat, down through the centuries, this is the blessing that is passed on to our sons, the sons of Israel to this day. Verse 21, Israel said to Joseph, I'm about to die. God will be with you and so forth. He will bring you back into the land. And since he's going to bring you back into the land, make sure he brings me back into the land. In other words, my bones are supposed to go with you. And so the text concludes in chapter 48. And now that he's done all this blessing, he's done, right? He's ready to die. No, chapter 49 is full of his blessings of his sons. And in this sense, as you read the blessings carefully, they are, in fact, not only characteristic, but predictive. Characteristic of the sons who would become the tribes, but also predictive as to what will be their destiny or their history. In one of the more popular versions of the readings for the week, and from week to week, the Stone Chumash, we're told, and I quote here because it's very perceptive and insightful, Jacob was about to bless the tribes individually, each in line with its own character and ability, so that they would be directed towards the paths for which God had suited them. I love that. So that it can be better directed for the paths for which God suited them. That's the way God operates in our lives, too, if we're paying attention. Anyhow, back to the quote, Jacob's blessings would make clear that each of the tribes had its own unique mission. We don't all do the same thing. And then it says, only Jacob could perceive this, because he's the one who's doubly blessed by God. He's been shepherded by God all his life. Anyhow, only Jacob could perceive this. As the zenith of the patriarchal and matriarchal era, Jacob had the ability to understand, catch that, the ability to understand each son's role in the scheme of the cosmos. In other words, as part of the plan and purpose of God throughout history and for the universe. Anyhow, back to this. And as he blessed them, he assigned his sons to their respective missions accordingly. It's a very important insight, very useful for us to understand. And we can see part of that. In other words, what he's doing, he's spelling out for them their history, their destiny, as a vital part of the purpose of God through the history of the world. And one of those blessings was read to you as well. It's from 49 verses 8 to 11. You know, it's the one about Judah. The scepter, the emblem of the rule, will not depart from Judah until Shiloh. later commentators consider that a messianic image shall come. And then it talks about a donkey and its colt and all those wonderful things. This becomes the indicator of the destiny of Judah to be the tribe from which the Messiah would come. Why a donkey and a colt? Well, some people take the passage poetically and say they both refer to the same thing, and poetically that's the way in which Hebrew poetry operates. But others take it quite literally. In fact, the Gospel of Matthew points out that when Yeshua came riding in, he came riding in on what? Nope. A donkey and a colt. Oh, yes. The point was not only to take us back to Zechariah, where the passage is predictive, but to take us back to this original blessing of destiny. There's much more there, but we've got to skip ahead to chapter 50, or we'll never get through this. And then, I love this particular section. Joseph is about to die. Jacob has died, and before Joseph is about to die, his brothers are afraid that they will go first. Why? Because Papa's no longer there to protect him. So they panic, and they come to Joseph, and they, in one sense, express their panic. And what does Joseph say? Verses 19 to 21. He says, "Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid of me. Am I in the place of God?" Very interesting that he would say that. Because in Egypt, he was in the place of God. We read the text last week. They considered Joseph to be like Pharaoh. They considered Pharaoh to be like God, to actually be the son of God. So he's reminding them that the Egyptian mythology is not something they need to worry about. And then here's a wonderful passage. "You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done, namely the saving of many lives." Boy, isn't that perceptive. And so then he assures them, "So don't be afraid. I will provide for you, not just for you, but for you and your children." And so he reassured them as he spoke kindly to them. In other words, what God did here was to turn a curse into a blessing. He took what was evil and turned it into good. Now, this should sound familiar to us, as this is as part of the nature of the God whom we are here to serve, because he's done this before and it's been reflected on before. In the book of Acts, Shimon HaShliach, Peter the Apostle, and the others are praying. And they're concerned about some of the opposition they're facing. And here's what their prayer is. They say, "Indeed, Herod and Pontius Pilate met together with the Gentiles and the people of Israel in this city." Oh, by the way, notice the order of blame here. We're last on the list, not first on the list, as is far too frequently mistold. Anyhow, back to the text. "They met together to conspire against your holy servant Yeshua, whom you anointed. But they did what your power and will had decided beforehand should happen. And we stand up and cheer." I didn't see anybody do that. But anyhow, you get the point. But don't miss the point. They just got finished quoting Psalm 2, and there's a reason. Because God had already said this is the kind of thing that would take place back in Psalm 2. "Why do the nations conspire?" The psalm begins. Conspire, same as in Acts. "And the peoples plot in vain. The kings of the earth rise up, and the rulers band against the Lord." Yeah, like Herod and Pontius Pilate. "Against the Lord and against his anointed," the same as you find in this prayer, his Messiah. "But the one enthroned in heaven laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. I have installed my king on Zion, my holy mountain. I have made sure that the king got to where he's supposed to. So," the psalmist says, "I will proclaim the Lord's decree," or the one who's being addressed says, "He said to me, 'You are my son. Today I've become your father.'" Interesting phrasing. But this, in effect, is what the prayer in Acts was to remind us of, because guess what? The people who prayed that prayer, the people who heard that prayer prayed, and those who read the text later, they knew that this was coming directly from Psalm 2, even if we may not have known it. Anyhow, "Ask me and I will make the nations your inheritance, the ends of the earth your possession. Therefore, you kings, be wise, be warned, you rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear, celebrate his rule with trembling. And then the text concludes, kiss his son, because blessed, oh, we get blessed again, are those who take refuge in him. This closing text of Genesis 50 is meant to reinforce the fact of the faithfulness and the kindness of God. You know, it began with Chesed Ve'emet, as well as to remind us of the graciousness of God, pain. But it also tells us something of the complete commitment to the covenant promises and relationship that is there on God's part. In other words, God had taken an oath like Jacob requested Joseph do for him at the beginning of our text. And this graciousness of God and his faithfulness and kindness was counted on and in fact reinforced by Joseph, because at the end of chapter 50, as his father had requested, so now Joseph requests. He says to his brothers, God's going to take you back to the land as he promised. He's committed to his covenant. Oh, and by the way, don't forget to take me with you. Take my bones with you. A number of years ago, interestingly enough, this is an aside in case you haven't figured it out. Just in case you haven't figured it out, let me illustrate it. A number of years ago, we had in this very room a seminar from, I think, a British archaeologist. And one of the things, as he unwrapped some very interesting things in his seminar, and I'm trying to remember his name, but I've lost it offhand. He showed to us what is in all likelihood the actual grave of Joseph. And guess what? There was no mummy in the sarcophagus. Interesting. Anyhow, back to our text. Joseph's request is identical in nature and terminology to his father's. His request is based on the same assurance that his father had. And now we've come yet again full circle from the beginning to the end of the parsha. Therefore, hopefully reinforcing the lessons for us about the faithfulness and the kindness of God, about the graciousness of God, about his concrete commitment to his covenant promises and relationship. But there's another pattern. And I forget when I discovered this in the lives of the patriarchs here. And if you look at the sermon notes, you'll find the pattern. Abraham, we're told, lived 175 years. Isaac, we're told, lived 180 years. Jacob, we're told, lived 147 years. If you factor this out, as I've done for you, you might see a potential answer to the question, why this particular number of years? Well, take a look at what I've given you in your notes. Abraham lived 5 times 5 times 7 years. Isaac lived 6 times 6 times 5 years. And Jacob lived 7 times 7 times 3 years. And if you add all the particular roots together, in each case, it's 17. Intriguing math. Now, this is not gematria or numerology. This is just mathematics. But it indicates something, I think, that is at least insightful. There's a progression that takes place from 5 to 6 to 7. But it's based on the same principles because they each add up to 17. I'm going to suggest that that indicates for us something that's indicated throughout the history of God's working on our behalf. It's the clear pattern, it indicates a clear pattern of connection in the lives of the patriarchs and the matriarchs. And it also indicates a clear purpose of God in their history. If we can just add in subtract and multiply numbers. I know here you're just adding and multiplying numbers. You can see some of the pattern. And this recognition, as well as the recognition we should have derived from this passage, should remind us of two things. It should provide us with confidence and assurance regarding God and the covenant made with us. which is why so often when we recite certain texts of scripture or prayers, we end them with amen, so be it. In other words, I'm confident, I have the assurance that God will do exactly what he said. But it should also not only provide confidence and assurance regarding God and his covenant promises, it should produce peace and serenity and tranquility regarding our lives and circumstances, as it shows, and he has shown for us in their lives and circumstances. That provides us with what we know of as shalom. Peace, serenity, tranquility. One of you sent this to me many years ago, and I filed it like I do with some of my email. Others' email becomes spam, but you understand how that works. It's called It Depends Whose Hands It's In. And I think this summarizes for us a good part of the lesson for this evening. A basketball in my hands is worth about $20 or whatever I pay for it. A basketball in LeBron James's hands is worth exactly $154 million. It depends on whose hands it's in. A baseball in my hands, which I love having there, is worth about $8 or $10 or whatever it might cost me to buy it. But in pitcher Gerrit Cole's hands, it's worth $324 million, which is what the Yankees are beginning to pay him. It depends on whose hands it's in. A tennis racket is it's not quite useless in my hands, but nearly useless. A tennis racket in Serena Williams' hands is a Wimbledon championship or several. It depends whose hands it's in. A rod in my hands will keep away a wild animal, if I don't drop it on my way to escape the situation. Anyhow, a rod in Moses' hands will part the mighty sea. It depends whose hands it's in. A slingshot in my hands is a kid's toy. A slingshot in David's hand is a mighty weapon. It depends whose hands it's in. Two fish and five loaves of bread in my hands is several fish sandwiches and a lot of extra bread. Two fish and five loaves of bread in God's hands will feed thousands. It depends on whose hands it's in. Nails in my hands might produce a birdhouse. On my better days. Nails in Yeshua's hands will produce the restoration of the entire world and cosmos. It depends whose hands it's in. As you see now, it all depends whose hands it's in. So put your concerns, your worries, your fears, your hopes, your dreams, your families and your relationships in God's hands because it depends whose hands it's in. And let me add, and the result will be a blessing, God's blessing on your heads. Take the next minute or so in quiet as you respond to God's hand reaching out to you.